Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, we got the best TVs of 2018 with Robert Herron, AMD's Ryzen 5 2500U mobile APU performance. Raven Ridge is here, battling server CPUs from AMD and Intel, and a Spectre patch you can trust and install. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 452, recorded February 8th, 2018. It's a good year to buy a new TV, people. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most affordable, most delightful, most expensive, most crazed, most mobile, most desktop hardware news available in this or any other known universe. I'm Patrick Norton, joined today by Mr. Robert Herron. Robert, are you with us, sir?
I believe I am, and thank you for inviting me.
Hey, man, thanks for joining us. We should talk, the obligatory mention before we really get going is that GPU prices are still high.
Glad I got in early.
Although
I don't think the GPU I have is actually anything anyone wants. I ended up grabbing a 6 gigabyte 1060 as an appropriate match for my current CPU power. So, and I'm thrilled with the damn thing. It's perfect. It was a nice boost from what I had anyway. So,
technically, you know, the GeForce GTX 1080 is down to $925, according to Camel. If you can actually find it. That's a third-party new price from a seller.
That seems expensive, no?
Questionable profit. Well, it is expensive, but considering they were selling for $1,100 a couple days ago, it may be cheap, and $1,400 a couple weeks before that. Compared to the MSRP, it's spectacularly expensive.
You can buy a lot of quality SSDs for that much money, and probably get a great system for that price, so...
You had a great three-day weekend in Vegas.
Maybe.
Well, at least on the... Maybe.
Maybe.
You operated a slightly more extravagant budget in Vegas than I did. Oh, my goodness. In any case, GPU prices have not come down.
But I take it this is due to the cryptocurrency mining shenanigans? Or just everyone trying to, I don't know, mine everything in sight, apparently. All cryptocurrencies, or is there one in particular that seems to be driving the whole?
Ethereum is probably the big one. Oh, wait. Hold on. Did I just add? Uh-oh. Oh, my goodness. I need to immediately call a friend of mine because I just found an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 1080 for $730 in stock at Best Buy. If I fall over, it's the shock, people.
but who makes it?
It's an EVGA. It's fine.
Oh, that's cool. They're awesome. Yeah. So,
oh my goodness, I get distracted. We should talk to you about as exciting as overpriced GPUs are. You are actually a television expert, and we should probably talk to you about what you saw at CES this year. I mean, go ahead.
There were many good things at CES regarding TVs. That's probably the biggest TV show in the United States, at least, every year. Come January, that second week of January, it kicks off. Many, many new exciting products being announced. Probably good to start with Samsung in the sense that they really didn't show any consumer TVs. They were only really showing off the Wall, which is their modular-based direct-lit micro LED display system, very similar to what they use in their cinema production or their cinema display systems that they've installed in a couple countries now. This is not going to be cheap. It's starting at 146 inches to get the appropriate 4K-ish resolution. You can scale this up as big as you want. Prices haven't been announced, but I would be willing to say it's approaching six figures. It is going to deliver epic brightness, full DCI color spec. And because it is literally using, for each subpixel, its own individual micro LED, when you turn those off, they aren't emitting any light. So you get excellent black levels, excellent viewing angles, and just a dynamic viewing experience. But that's definitely not for everyone. I think Of course, one of the best values we encountered last year was TCL and their P series, that P607, a 55-inch screen that delivered ample light output, support for all the popular HDR formats, in addition to having Roku TV built in. And that turned out to be the phenomenal value that you could score for about $650 if you were in the market for something in that size range, that 55-inch screen size. This year, they're going to bring back the 6 series just straight up. And that's going to be very similar in performance to what we were seeing last year. It will incorporate an updated frame design, making it look a lot more premium in terms of just the styling of the TV itself. It also incorporates the latest rev of Roku TV, which they were showing off, that incorporated a bunch of cool features, especially if you do over-the-air tuning, where you use an antenna to receive your broadcast content for free. Roku TV is updating their platform to incorporate a 2-week channel guide, as well as improve search functions to find the content you're looking for, no matter where it may be it streaming services or over-the-air broadcasts or however. And perhaps the favorite part of my whole announcement related to the Roku software update was the fact that it's going to be applied to all the Roku products going back to 2014, at least the TVs. So that's just going to be one of the fantastic values you'll be able just to, everyone will be able to enjoy in terms of going forward. And if you have that Roku product, expect that software to be pushing soon, so to speak. Who else was at the show? Sony. Sony always shows off cool stuff in their booth regarding, usually not in addition to all their new 4K TVs, be it LCD or OLED, they were also showing off a prototype display as well. This was a 85-inch 8K screen highlighting their new X1 Ultimate prototype video processor. Key features on this TV, 10,000 nit light output. And yeah, beautiful DCI color spec, all of it. This is effectively a TV for the first time I've seen anywhere that matches the spec for HDR and 4K video. And the beauty there is that when it's fed a signal, say from an ultra high def Blu-ray disc, say that disc is describing a scene with a 4,000 nit highlight in it, or a 6,000 nit highlight, or a glint off a piece of chrome, the TV doesn't have to really do anything processing wise to map that into lower performance levels. It simply says, oh, you need a 8,000 nit highlight in the scene. There it is. And those types of processing are referred to as tone mapping. And so effectively now you have a prototype display. Yeah, but generally this will be something you'll see in a couple more years down the road. But you have a display that can effectively match the performance characteristics of the HDR spec. And it is phenomenal in terms of image quality. I stood literally 3 feet away from the display, 10,000 nits. It's not as if the whole screen is pure white blowing out that kind of light. It's really just the highlights in the scene. And the cues you get from especially natural content, be it they were shooting some beautiful vehicles, outdoor nature scenes and things like that, it's far more realistic than anything I've ever seen before in terms of it looked like an outdoor daylit scene, and it wasn't overwhelming to my eyes. And the other factor it really highlighted for me. Oh, go ahead.
We should put this into context because, you know, we saw a lot of stuff at CES 2018 from like, oh my goodness, you know, Samsung's going to catch up, to oh my goodness, OLEDs from LG got better, to oh my goodness, oh, yeah, you know, Hisense is back in it. But the thing that blew you away more than anything else was having this 10K television from Sony that was delivering an absolute full HDR spec. I just want to put that in.
Totally.
You were talking about that for like a week and a half afterwards with great intensity and admiration.
It's that fact that I really expected it to take a lot longer to get a TV that could do full spec HDR, considering the spec itself defines a certain color output. No TV is hitting the full Rec 2020 color palette, but the one most commonly used within Hollywood is called DCI, and it's a subset of that, larger than our current HD color palette. And it provides more saturated, realistic colors, especially when you're dealing with very saturated objects, be it a beautiful Ferrari red paint job or the Caribbean blue in certain scenes, that cyan color that's just unobtainable in the old spec. And not only that, but with that amount of light output, it can literally match it without having to resort to tone mapping. And beyond that, the other thing it really highlighted to me was that we talk about LG's OLEDs and OLED technology in general, that ability to do that perfect black, really improves the perception of color saturation. Colors look more saturated when they have a dark color next to them, or if it is a black background and that is pure black, the colors will look more rich and vibrant compared to a TV that has a black level that is not quite pure black, maybe a dull gray or even a dark gray. On the other end of that is when you have a TV that can dump out 10,000 nits, that alone also makes color look more saturated and bright. Physically, the colors are brighter coming off the screen and into your eyes. That was as impressive to my eyes as is a pure black, you know, background, say, on an OLED screen. Now, when the Sony TV did go to a full black screen, it clearly didn't have the absolute best black levels ever. However, it was a pure prototype, and it was fantastic to look at. Other than that, they showed off a brand new, or I should say an updated OLED screen for this year that gets away from the easel-style design of last year with the A1e and the 8F8, I believe it is called. That will feature a more traditional design, yet still integrating Sony's application of a technology that allows them to produce sound directly out of the screen itself. The screen is the set of stereo speakers using physical actuators on the back of the TV that vibrate that glass in such a way to produce sound that for all intents and purposes comes directly out of the picture itself. But you have to back that up with a little bit of low-end performance too. Usually in the case of the A1e, they had a 4-inch speaker built into that TV to provide a little bass oomph. And on this TV, they're switching, I believe, to a couple of smaller speakers to achieve similar effect. So that is just going to be, in addition, I think, just a fantastic product. LG, of course, they were highlighting the new 8 series panels, showing off many cool things about it. I didn't see anything to say that the absolute performance of the panels will change much from last year, the 7 series, to this year. The jump from the 6 series to the 7 series was significant in terms of lots of little things that added up to a much better picture. For the 8 series, I'd say the picture quality is going to be very similar, but they've added a few new features, including Google Assistant, that worked flawlessly. And perhaps more important to a video file would be something called black frame insertion. The TVs will be able to insert a dark frame between the typically held images that are used in LCDs and OLEDs when displaying motion video. This will improve the perception of motion resolution to the point of what plasmas were capable of doing back in the day. The gold standard for motion resolution has always been a plasma screen because of the nature of how it produces imagery. This feature called black frame insertion, by adding that to the OLEDs, you're effectively creating something very similar with the trade-off being some reduced light output. Now, with the Sony A1e last year, they actually introduced this feature already. However, and I've seen this on other LCDs as well that employ similar technology, but it can add a flicker to the screen that is at best annoying and at worst unwatchable. And on the 8 series OLEDs from LG coming out this year, I saw at least no perceptible flicker to my eye, and it was good enough to where I would really consider leaving it on all the time. If you can take a sacrifice in the light output a little bit, you will achieve phenomenal motion resolution without resorting to motion compensation and estimation techniques that can introduce an overly smooth picture, particularly with movies where, you know, in order to get that motion resolution out of an LCD, if you went into the video processing settings, you would be enabling things that would make that picture go from looking like cinema to looking like video, where it's just too smooth on everything. And it appeared effective. It appeared wonderful, and absolutely loved it. Another super geeky thing for the new LG TVs is the ability to go in and write calibration tables directly to the TV. And we're talking something that goes far beyond just simple grayscale and color setup. This can incorporate anywhere from 100 to a few thousand points of calibration detail. Being able to measure this, directly write it to the TV's what they call the lookup table, and then have it effectively across the entire color palette and through a range of luminances produce something that's really approaching what you get out of pro monitors on the pro side of things. And while it is kind of nerdy, it does require special software and the gear to do it. It looked and performed phenomenally, and I can't wait to see the final iteration of that and to get it in my hands. It will simply make those TVs, especially anyone that wants to use them in a pro environment, far better, or eliminate the need for adding a separate lookup table box. And at least as a video nerd, I find that's the right way to do it. You compare that to, say, Samsung's TVs that introduced an AutoCal feature last year that literally is only controlling the controls already built into the TV through the main menu system. This is far more detailed. You can literally, with the higher end OLEDs, you'll be accessing up to 35,000 points of correction information. And while you're not going to be programming each one of those separately, this will enable just phenomenal, accurate picture quality across the board.
TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand. You mentioned earlier that it was kind of like that 55-inch television was everybody's pick for the best deal for a 4K HDR TV last year.
Oh, I wanted to say, too, they are going to bring the 65-inch out this year as well as part of their new six series TVs. And that worked so well last year at such a good price point. That's just going to be, I think, your go-to option if you're on a budget. And nothing I saw there in any way showed me that they were going backwards in terms of keeping that 6 Series a high-performing, compatible set with things like Dolby Vision, HDR10, and probably even HLG down the road. Now, over in the Hisense booth, they showed off some phenomenal new 4K televisions that use quantum dot technology to improve the color palette. In addition to their H10, is going to provide up to, I believe, 1,000 zones of local dimming, 2,000 nits of light output. And there is seriously something going on with the LCD manufacturers, on the high end at least, in terms of off-axis viewing. I am seeing far less glare and halo effects that might appear on, say, a bright object on a dark scene. It is approaching the look of what I would think of as OLED-like performance. And Hisense typically is going to bring this at a very competitive price point. And this is one of those TVs where it just catches your attention because of that expanded color palette and that deep dark black with lots of zones of local dimming. And that should be at the top of everyone's list to check out as soon as it rolls. And they also had an H9 Plus, which will be an edgelet based system as well, that came really close to what the H10 was doing. And I think those are going to be two wonderful sets to compare to even some of the very best LCDs coming out this year. Now, I will say, in a private meeting with Samsung, they did show off a prototype of their upcoming consumer models. And it was a canned demo in their private suite. But what they showed was so close to what I expect out of an OLED that I almost didn't believe what I was seeing. And I'm still pouring over my notes in terms of technically what they're doing to achieve not only exceptional black levels, but the ability to control those halo and blooming artifacts, in addition to the off-axis viewing, something I expect every LCD just to simply get worse and worse the further you move off dead center straight on. Typically, the screen gets, the black levels increase, the colors wash out, things like that. I was seeing very little of that in the demos I was presented. Granted, they were demos. There isn't even a model number for these things yet, but pretty phenomenal stuff if what I saw holds to the final shipping product. Now, Samsung also introduced a super premium 85-inch 4K. I think it was 4K. I don't think it was 8K. But they have a premium set coming down the road that has up to 10,000 zones of local dimming, 4,000 nits of light output. And at an 85-inch screen size, you're talking a solid five figures for that. But again, phenomenal performance. I thought the LCD guys were going to crawl into a hole after last year with OLED just kind of dominating everything. But that is not the case. And I think for sure 2018 is going to be the best LCDs on the planet in terms of at least the premium models.
My goodness. It's going to be it seems like it's another good year to buy televisions outside of LG separating the models. Where last year you essentially had the same glass and the same processor. Now, if you pay more money, you get a better processor. That's pretty much the same glass.
That's
interesting. But it still seems like it's going to be a good year for televisions.
I think this will be the best year yet. And also, because of new production techniques and new factories coming online, the larger OLED screens, particularly that 77-inch, that may be the drool-worthy thing you want, but you look at the price tag and it's like, maybe something else. They have new facilities coming online that are going to make that cheaper. And that 77-inch size is going to creep down into the C-series. So I'm really hoping we'll see something in like the hopefully the $8,000 range, maybe for that 77-inch panel, making it far more affordable than what it was even a year ago.
Right. Well, I don't know.
Going back to LG, though, real quick.
HDR projectors. Wow. Going back to LG.
No, yeah. Just going back to LG real quick. They did show off two new processors. You did mention the differentiation compared to last year, where we had similar chipsets and similar glass across the entire line for the most part. For 2018, they are breaking it up just a little bit. My understanding is that the glass will be the same in terms of absolute picture performance, but within the TVs themselves, their entry level, the B series, is going to use a processor that's a step back from what the C and above series are going to use. Effectively similar on most aspects, except for some specific functions related to doing high frame rate and HDR at the same time, in addition to the addressable calibration points that I could go in and dial a TV into. It should still look and perform beautifully. However, if you're looking for the absolute best from LG this year, it's going to be their OLED starting in the C series and up. And also, going back to Hisense, just one last thing. They did show off a 4K laser projector that at first I thought was simply just a bump up in luminance. They're talking, oh, we're instead of our 100-inch screen size, we're going to have 150-inch. And I'm like, okay, well, you just bump the light output up? But no, this will be that model I've mentioned before that incorporates a dual laser setup where they're using a red and a blue laser with appropriate phosphors. And the key here is that it will be able to deliver, they're claiming 100% of the DCI color palette with a true 4K DLP imager in a package that also incorporates smart TV functionality. So you have your apps and streaming stuff built in addition to just Harman Kardon audio. But having that dual color laser setup and being able to achieve full DCI color with a 4K imager is something that is reserved for only the super premium projectors that are two or three times the cost currently. And if they can hit a $10,000 price point or less, and they're claiming they're going to have this out by the end of the year, that is just going to be one to keep your eye on to see if they can deliver on that, because that just represents a price point for technology that we really don't have access to yet. Usually when you think of 4K projectors, you're either getting a projector that has true 4K resolution, but it has the old school color palette. And none of these TVs will be able to produce the light output of an none of these projectors will be able to produce the light output of a premium LCD. However, these are laser based as well, at least the ones from Hisense and others that I'm talking about. And that gives you the robust ability to just run that system continuously for, you know, they're claiming 20,000+ hours without needing to change a bulb or a lamp. And that should just provide just ample output. And the only other company I've seen do this dual color laser setup currently available is through Christie Digital. And they have some pro projectors that they use in commercial installations that feature this technology. But I haven't seen anything for the home yet. And Hisense claims they're building all of this in-house and it's all covered under their patents. And I am really looking forward to that as well. And one last thing in the Hisense booth, they did show off a live ATSC3 demo using a transmitter literally that was mounted 5 feet away, but the TV hardware was using what was built in to receive that signal, display 4K HDR content that looked fantastic, in addition to a mobile device they had there as well that was receiving the same signal. So one of the things to think about the new broadcast format coming up is that it will be delivering 4K HDR to the home if you're close enough to the towers. And in addition to that, it will also be delivering to mobile devices that are compatible with this as well. Probably not in 4K, but TV on your phone, a live TV feed that you can pick up when you're near the broadcast towers should be usable for, I think, quite a few people and should be pretty cool. And I'm also looking forward to some of the other specs that they've wrapped into ATSC3 that relate to how it's transmitted. And it should help improve distance and its ability to deal with multipath interference and other features like that that can degrade your signal. Or if you're living right on the border of getting a watchable picture or not, I'm really hoping that these new tuners and technology will go a long way toward helping folks who want to enjoy some free TV with appropriate hardware in the best way possible.
We should probably mention one last thing from Hisense before we move on, which was your favorite thing in the Hisense booth, which was not actually a product that Hisense has any interest in shipping.
Oh, Hisense, I visited the with them a couple of years back. They have these cool retro TVs, literally, yeah. And they take an LCD panel, 4K, decent performance. It looks great, probably on the value side of things more than the high performance. But the chassis it's installed in really throws back to the old retro designs with a physical knob or two, in addition to rabbit ears that incorporate ATSC tuner. And they look fantastic, just in as an eye-catching design. And the knobs themselves felt that right there, baby. That was fun to play with. And it worked really well. And yeah, this is something the design group likes to show off. But generally, they never seem to make their way into stores. And I think if they can hit the right price point, that would attract, I think, more eyeballs, given how boring many of the value TVs look in terms of just their physical design. This was something kind of unique, eye-catching. And I hate to use the word cute, but yeah, it was cute as hell. I really like those TVs for some reason. It's just something a little different.
That's cute as hell is a pretty high endorsement.
I don't know. Hopefully Hisense appreciates it. So
I would imagine. AMD Ryzen 5 2500U mobile APU performance. We're talking Raven Ridge here, as in I'm excited about this, right? We've been talking about this for a while. You know, this is a quad core mobile CPU with Radeon Vega graphics in a 15 watt TDP, which basically means GPU performance a little bit better, hopefully, than Intel. You know, that's pretty exciting, right? Of course, we also at CES, you know, had the confirmation on the Kaby Lake G platform, the Intel with the Vega graphics. But Ken over at PC Per got to play around with a HP Envy X360 laptop that was running a Ryzen 5 2500U. Probably not with the SSD it's going to ship with. There's some questions about that, but 8 gigabytes of DDR, 15.6 inch 1920 by 1080 monitor. The storage, which is kind of a question mark, that 1 terabyte Samsung PM961 NVMe SSD. You know, a pretty good set of specs, $1,329, which is kind of typical for a fairly, you know, I thought it was thin and light, but it looks like it's weighing in at 4.75 pounds. So it's not that light. But the caveat on this one was the power consumption. The chart you're looking at right now, that top set of bars is a Ryzen 5 2500U and that HP X360. You know, and you're maxing out at like 41 to 43 watts if you're looking at Counter-Strike or Rocket League. The one that's higher at 52 watts, that's a Core i5 8250 system with a GTX 150 inside of it, I want to say, or an MX150 inside of it. So that's a discrete NVIDIA graphics package, if I'm not mistaken. So the power is considerably higher, about 30% higher than most of the other GPU, like CPUs sitting in that space. But the CPU and gaming performance is not bad. Not epic, but certainly hanging there with a Core i5-7200 or a Core i5-8250U, you know, looking at single-thread performance, multi-thread performance, you know, a little bit lagging.
Gaming performance looks solid, though. And I think,
yeah.
I mean, for me personally, I don't think I'll ever buy a notebook that weighs more than 3 pounds again. So being able to get these kind of components crammed into thinner, more power efficient designs is where I want it to go anyway. I'm currently using Intel integrated graphics, and I ain't getting anywhere near any of those levels of performance in my current relatively new notebook. But at the same point, I'm also rolling around with something that weighs over a pound less. So
yeah, that's a big deal. I mean, it's been interesting. Like, I'm looking at, I should point out the Cinebench, it's actually ahead of that Core i5-8250U. I always forget which one is higher and lower in that one, but it's kind of crazy to look at those gaming numbers look pretty good. You know, they're obviously getting beat by the one with the discrete graphics, but you're looking at a pretty good, you know, compared to the other, you know, compared to the 4i5-8250U, it's delivering a pretty nice jump in performance. Again, if you go to discrete graphics, it gets crushed, but that's a kind of a totally different market segment. So it's good. I don't think we have final pricing numbers on this, although it seems to be pretty solid in that $1,300 range. I'm kind of curious to see how many vendors adopt this and when it comes out. And I mean, it's also funny that you mentioned about the performance on the ultralight laptops, because I got to take a look at what should have been a significantly faster processor inside of a Microsoft laptop. And what was amazing is because it was fanless, it could not run that Core i7 processor at anywhere near the top speed. So,
oh, I bet.
You know, my technically, you know, several, you know, it was, you know, compared to the slower processor in my XPS 13, which has a pretty robust cooling system, the performance of that Microsoft laptop was considerably lower. And that was surprising to me. You know,
well, if you don't have that active cooling, you would assume that you're never going to hit the peak performance of that thing unless you're using it out in the cold or something. But
that's a good point.
It's nice to have no sound coming from a PC, but even my ultra lightweight notebook has a little fan built into it that I do hear kick up whenever I'm doing anything CPU intensive or GPU intensive. So
I think it's just frustrating at this point, when you're looking at like a $3,000 laptop that performs considerably slower than a laptop that sells for just over half the price. You know, your $3,000 laptop with a faster processor should be at least as fast as something that costs considerably less. I don't know. It was a curious one to look at. Something kind of came out of the blue and blew me away. To start mixing metaphors for the sheer unbridled joy of it. Mozilla is created the Things Gateway and build your own Web of Things Gateway on a Raspberry Pi. So, you know, you'll need USB dongles to do Zigbee and Z-Wave, but they have a pre-built Raspberry Pi OS image that their goal is to turn a Raspberry Pi into a controller for all the Internet of Things devices in your house. So this is kind of their next step from Project Things by Mozilla. That's their framework of software and services. The idea that they're going to create this open platform for vendors to work on, which I'm kind of excited about. I don't know if anybody will adopt it, because obviously we have these big battles going on for controlling the home and voice automation in the home and everything else. But I'm pretty excited. I'm going to start playing around with Things Gateway this weekend.
That's pretty cool. I mean, the fact that you can just simply plug in the dongles you plan to use, be it for, like you mentioned, the Zigbee or the Z-Wave technologies, if those are the devices and of the IoT things you're using in your home. This might bring some of the control back into your hands, at least. I'm more curious about the software interface they're going to be providing within their OS build for this, to see how you go about setting things up. Will it require any kind of cloud connection, or is it something you literally could do on a local scale to really just lock it down, if nothing else. So,
if you go into hacksmozilla.org, they've got sort of the complete set of instructions on it. And to add things, you click on it's actually a very nicely designed screen. I just put a link into the show notes for this one. You click on a plus icon on the bottom right of the screen. Puts all the attached adapters into pairing mode. You'll see a couple of devices show up on the thing screen there. That's when the devices show up. And scroll down to the next window. You know, and it will give you sort of like options for that. It's reporting, like, that shows the plug reporting its power consumption, its voltage, its current and frequency. And you scroll down and it's crazy because you can access a rules engine, and they allow you to set if this, then that style rules for, you know, to chain devices together, make devices work together, you know. And the example there is if smart plug A turns on, turn on smart plug B. So it looks like a really aesthetically pleasing array. It has the ability to put a floor plan in there so you can position your devices and figure out where they are in your house. You know, they've got,
I think, for wikis. Tablet use, I see a lot of people adopting tablets and putting them in wall mount brackets simply to have that kind of, you know, touchscreen display control right within the home. And if this is going to be simply something you can full screen on a device like that, that brings some functionality where you can really simplify the use of a home full of these types of devices for the rest of the family members who really need it simplified in order to make it something acceptable within the household itself. So that looks cool. And I look forward to actually checking that out. I have a Raspberry Pi that is currently, I think, unused at the moment. And considering how easy it is to simply swap out an SD card for another one to, you know, add an IoT OS. Why not? This looks like something I would definitely want to try out. And we've had, I'll be curious to see if you can do anything, what other devices I can control with this as well, beyond, say, Zigbee and Z-Wave. Maybe it's just limited to that for a good reason, though. So we'll see.
Those would probably be the most popular ones. But
yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Kyle over at Hard OCP has got a fun project going where they basically decided to pay for a Threadripper, an AMD 1950X, with cryptocurrency mining. So, you know,
okay. He pointed,
this was pitched to them by AMD. It was not something they came up with. But I was laughing about that, where the idea of, can you generate enough, can you mine enough coin, cryptocurrency, to pay for the cost of a Threadripper 1950X? I believe the answer is yes. And if you're curious about that one, I'm going to send you to Hard OCP. You know, that's a $900 16-core 32-thread processor. And I thought it was kind of interesting to see that. And the CPU and GPU combined, you're looking at about 335 watts to get 2005 hashes per second. So the hash rates are pretty good on that. That's about as in-depth on that as I can go. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the conversations we had with somebody at CES was related to this very subject, and they described their own personal setup where it would dynamically look at all the available mineable currencies, switch between whatever one was providing the most profit on a real-time basis. So they weren't just doing one particular type of mining. They were covering all their bases and then having the system they had set up trip itself to switch between the different currencies when appropriate for maximum profit or whatever they were, probably what their goal was. But I'm surprised that was just one person. So you think there's probably quite a few people doing something similar. And with the Samsung announcement recent too, with their Samsung's actually gotten into the business now of making cryptocurrency ASICs straight up. They had demonstrated.
Third parties.
That's true. They had demonstrated, I think it was at Cydia. I think they actually had a tower of how to repurpose old cell phones. And they actually took like about 20 of their Galaxy 5 phones and put them together to make a miner that way as well. But seeing systems like these, and I'd be curious to see on Hard OCP how they did their software setup, to how they, you know, how they will deal with the variety of currencies out there and how they pick and choose between them in terms of trying to make a system that pays for itself, at least.
I like the idea. Toys that pay for themselves are good. Oh, my goodness. Dell gets epic with AMD. Good article up this in the Register. Basically, Dell's bringing 1 and 2 socket rack mount servers, says the Register, using AMD EPYC processors alongside its Xeon SP server family. The EPYC processor, says the Register, is said to be faster than equivalent Xeons. So it's interesting to watch AMD start to pick up, hopefully, a little traffic in the server market. And then sort of at the same time that's happening, Intel is refreshing the Skylake base Xeon D systems on a chip. So 2100 series. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I have a preference, at least on workstations, for the server style chips. They seem like better parts overall, in the fact that they also typically run at much cooler temperatures compared to, say, the regular desktop processors. So they also seem to overclock quite nicely as well, at least a version that would be unlocked or capable of being played with in that manner. So I don't discount Xeon as something that's only for servers. I also look at it for potentially just making a solid workstation as well. So,
well, in this case, a lot of these, I mean, you're talking about processors that start at $500, top up at, you know, $2,400 for a 18 core CPU. So these are pretty
good
ninja
point.
Stuff. Ninja parts, I should say. What's kind of crazy is they're saying, quote, Tim Berry up on PC Per, according to Intel, the new chips are squarely aimed at edge computing and offer up to 2.9 times the network performance, 2.8 times the storage performance, and 1.6 times the compute performance of the previous generation Xeon D1500 series. So that's a pretty huge jump. You know, and you're looking at like quick assist technology for hardware accelerated encryption and decryption, you know, four DDR4 memory channels that can hit up to 512 gigabytes of DDR4, you know, like four 10 gigabit Ethernet controllers, 32 lanes of PCIe. I mean, these are massive high performance chips. So I got to ask, you know, anything else you're excited about? I mean, what are you excited about in home theater right now? We do, I should point out, Robert Heron and I do a podcast called AV Excel. It's about home theater and audio. We love the headphones. We love the screens. We got deep on the screens for you there. What are you most excited about right now? Would it be cold in Korea?
It's freezing there, no doubt. However, I would say that demonstration of being able to access a lookup table on a TV, a consumer TV, in the case of LG's new 8 series panels. And I believe this will apply to at least one of their LCDs, the premium SK9500 as well. That just brings them into a level where it makes my job easier a little bit. And it also makes for just arguably the best type of calibration you can do on a panel like that, short of adding additional hardware externally in order to do something similar. That for me is just going to be the big one. Yeah, the good folks at SpectraCal, now owned by Portrait Displays, with their CalMan software, we were using alpha versions of this software, and it seemed to work really, really well. And for that, I am super excited about. What else? In the quest for looking at what's upcoming in these TVs, I realized that I'm just about at the limit of what my calibration gear can handle in terms of light output. I believe both of my meters currently top out at around 1600 nits or so. And that gets me to about 90%+ of all the displays I deal with. But sooner than later, I'm going to be seeing things that go well into the 2000 plus range. And for that, I have to upgrade my own hardware. And nothing is cheap in this realm, as far as I can tell. If you may as well buy good equipment, and it makes your life a little bit easier, but the outlay gives me pause for just a moment. So I have a new signal generator that kind of combines a couple that I'm using right now. So I'll have integrated support for things like Dolby Vision, HDR10, HLG, and all the other potential future formats in one single box, where I use currently a couple different ones for different aspects of that. In addition to, I'm looking at a meter right now that will handle up to 10,000 nits and provide even faster performance in the darkest scenes. Typically with a really accurate meter, it tends to go a lot slower when you're trying to measure a very dark color or a dark shade of gray, so to speak, because of there's just not as much light to trigger the sensors inside. And I'm looking forward to, I have the bid out right now, and I'm seeing what kind of pricing I can get. And that excites me on just the hardware side of it. Beyond that, I'm trying to think of what else. Olympic coverage. I mean, that's the big one for me right now. The disappointment of the limited 4K, effectively, it's very similar to what we were dealing with the Summer Games last time around, in terms of it's, for the most part, all delayed. There will be no live 4K UHD coverage. And then the sources of that content are also quite limited to the two main satellite providers here in North America, in addition to Comcast with their service platform. And of those three, only Comcast is providing an on-demand viewing experience if you have appropriate hardware and subscription packages. So this was the one time I really hoped that, at least in North America for NBC, that they would have updated their own streaming app, which is very cool, by the way. I don't want to discount the whole NBC Sports app. It makes it simple to schedule, find, view live content, but not in 4K. Also VR, if you want to. Hopefully it's better than last time around, but it just makes it a great way to watch and keep track of your favorite events in a way. Or if you missed one of your favorite events, to go back and rewatch it again. I was just hoping for this time around we would see something really taking advantage of today's best TVs in more of a real-time or a live. It's not like they can't do it. It just never happened, or it was the last thing they were thinking about rolling up to this show. Every camera being used to record the Olympics is at a minimum of 4K in HDR, in wide color palette, and it's frankly a shame in this day and age that we don't have more of that content more easily accessible. And it's a little disappointing, but at the same point, hey, the games have already started, so we can get our curling on, we can get the ski jump events, and then we have the opening ceremonies tomorrow night. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful for the next summer games, at least, that this mess will be shaken out a little bit better. Maybe they're all waiting for ATSC 3 for some reason, although there's no reason they can't. And at least here in North America, we've seen live events done in 4K 60 with HDR effect. Granted, they're usually like a one-off event, but it is entirely possible to do this with streaming hardware. And why it didn't happen in time for the Winter Games right now is baffling to me. And I'm a little disappointed in that, but not in the amount of coverage that's available, and certainly the ease of being able to find this content as well. Oh, I also just found out, too, if you are a subscriber to services like, at least with PlayStation View, I know this for sure, that if you have that subscription already, you can use that to access the NBC Sports app in its entirety if you choose to do so and you want to watch it on a separate device or your mobile or, another streaming product. But that's one of the beauties. I was wondering if it was going to require, say, a Comcast, DirecTV, or Dish Network subscription in order to get access to that, or one of the other cable or satellite providers in North America. But apparently there are some over-the-top services, at least with the PlayStation View service, which I've used personally, and I think it's a phenomenal alternative to regular cable or satellite service in terms of cost and what you get and how well it works. So there are some good options out there. And if you are a person with internet only, there are ways of watching the Olympic content live and streaming using at least services like PlayStation View.
It's exciting. Something just popped up on my screen.
Oh, my.
Literally, which turns out actually, I don't know how it dropped into the feed it dropped into because it came out late yesterday. But PC World reports that Intel has released stable Spectre patches for Skylake PCs recovering from a bad bout of bugs. So it is, if you have a Skylake-based PC and receive a patch to address the Spectre vulnerabilities, install it. Intel has greenlit the code, writes Mark Hockman, who is a fantastic reporter and senior editor over at PC World now. This is 2 weeks after Intel basically said, stop. Roll back any of the Spectre and Meltdown patches we sent out.
We're ruining old computers left and right.
Skylake is not that old, right? But Skylake-based Core M processors are safe. And then apparently Haswell and Broadwell patches are in testing, but the final patch code has not shipped yet. Yeah.
We'll see.
Skylake U, Y, H, and S series chips, as well as the U23E.
See, I'm not convinced that Intel, if Intel is saying this is safe, I'm going to wait for a couple of third parties to really hammer on it a little bit to see what the real world effect is instead of maybe what the claimed effect is, especially at that last go around where I believe people were experiencing systems that effectively bricked or got into insane boot loops or other just wackiness afoot when you're trying to...
Well, to put this kind of into context, there's a microcode PDF, microcode revision guidance. And if you look at this chart, you can see kind of where they are in terms of the updates on this. And there's this long list. Scroll down a little bit to the revision list. I could be wrong, but if I'm reading this chart properly, the ones with green have the updates. So that looks like it's that's the Skylake, and we'll see for Broadwell and Haswell. So exciting stuff, people. You've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, a.k.a. Twitch. You can find all our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/Twitch. Our regular host is Ryan Shroud of PCPer.com. I am Patrick Norton of TechThing and AVXL.com. And the guy joining us right now from Heron Fidelity and also AVXL, my co-host on AVXL, is Mr. Robert Heron. Robert, thank you so much for making the time today, man.
Oh, anytime. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
Catch next week on This Week in Computer Hardware.
Or AVXL. Go check it out. AVXL.com.